Hi, I'm Chris Marie. I'm so glad you're listening. In conflict, do you ever walk on eggshells, avoid sharing your honest opinion, or even hesitate to say no? Well, no more. Susan and I created a Speak Up Kit just for you. It's an easy-to-use, proven step-by-step process to find your voice and reduce your stress. To learn more, go to thriveinc.com/speak up. That's www.thriveinc.com/speakup. Hi, I'm Chris Marie Campbell.
And I'm Susan Clark.
And today we have a special guest. Dr. Wendy Troxell is a senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation and an adjunct professor at the University of Pittsburgh and University of Utah. She is the author of the book, Sharing the Covers, Every Couple's Guide to Better Sleep. Can't wait to talk about that. In which she shares her extensive research and clinical experience on the importance of healthy sleep for healthy relationships. She's an internationally recognized sleep expert whose work is regularly cited by the media, including CNN, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the BBC, as well as the ABC News and top-tier medical journals. She has two TED Talks to her name, one of which has been viewed over 2.4 million times. It's amazing. And Dr. Troxell's mission is to help people understand the power of sleep to support health, well-being, productivity, and relationships. So welcome, Dr.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm great. I'm thrilled to be here with both of you.
Since we do couples work and conflict and the whole idea of sleep and even sleep through menopause is a whole nother thing with two women. Imagine that. So I think sleep is such a, it can be a hot topic. And the fact that you wrote a book on it, talk more about how you got even interested in it.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to talk about a topic that's near and dear to my heart. Kind of my origin story in sleep really starts from the early days of my research when I was getting my PhD. I started out actually as a relationships researcher, really studying how and why it is that people who are in relationships, and particularly those who are in happy or healthy relationships, tend to live longer, happier, and healthier lives than those who are unpartnered or in unsatisfying or unhappy relationships. And through that work, I also wanted to understand, well, why it is, because this was a really robust finding that relationships are powerfully linked with not just our mental health, but also our physical health. So why was that? That's how I really stumbled upon sleep, because, you know, 20 years ago, that's when we started to see this rollout of substantial amounts of work demonstrating the critical importance of sleep for our cardiovascular functioning, for our mental health, for our cognitive health, really for every aspect of our health and functioning. And I, as a relationships researcher, wanting to understand why relationships matter for health, had the thought, well, wait a second, sleep is vitally important to our health. And most people share a bed with a partner, you know, if they're in a couple. And yet the vast majority of sleep research wasn't viewing sleep that way. You know, sleep was viewed as this very isolated individual behavior, completely devoid of the social environment or the social experience. And so I really kind of found my niche there, really not many or anybody was studying this. It really was important for my understanding of why relationships could matter for health. But then there was also this very basic question of how do couples sleep together? You know, what are the challenges couples face when sleeping together or not? And all of these sort of societal attitudes about the marital bed that just weren't science-based.
Wow.
I don't know whether I read this. Well, I'm not sure where I read it. But the whole idea that also so much of science research is done in labs outside of the normal setting where people are sleeping anyway. So I'm also very curious how you collected some of the research and has any of that shifted over time? Because that does seem two people in a bed very different than in a lab bed somewhere.
Or a single person in a lab bed.
Exactly. Well, there's groundbreaking early work in sleep science was very much about isolating the individual in tightly controlled laboratory conditions, free from disruptions, free from noise, free from movement in the bed where light was controlled, the temperature was perfect. And that was very important for us to build the science to where it is now to really understand the basics of sleep. But sort of where I entered the sleep world and really how my approach has been throughout my career is to understand sleep how it occurs, like in the wild, in the as it's actually happening. And the reality is sleep in the real world is often noisy, interrupted, and for many people, shared. And so then you have two people and you're trying to accommodate two behaviors in a tight space for a large proportion of our time. So that's the other thing that I thought was so fascinating about couples and sleep. Here, sleep occupies about a third of our lives. And so for a couple, that's a lot of your coupled existence. And yet neither sleep researchers nor relationship researchers or relationship therapists, for that matter, were even having a conversation about, oh, well, what's going on with that third of the night or, you know, third of one's lives that the couple share together?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I want to hear kind of what you hear as your findings, because, I mean, we made sure we got a mattress that Susan's movement didn't bother me. We have a chili pad, so we have temperature controlled underneath us. Blackout blinds, you know, all sorts of different things. So you still have the dogs that make the...
They're not on the bed, though.
No, we don't
have four living beings on the bed. It's not
too much. So can you talk about kind of what the pain points are and how... do you talk about how to support the couple? Share more about those things.
Yes. I mean, some of the things that you mentioned are all great strategies that couples can do to sort of maximize the sleeping environment for a shared space. Because again, just because you love a person doesn't mean you're going to be completely compatible with regard to your temperature preferences or, you know, your sleep behaviors. Maybe one of you is really restless in your sleep who tosses and turns, and maybe the other is, we've identified that one.
And you guys, people see it. Just pointing at Susan. So
things that you can do to sort of at the environmental level include, you know, mattresses that sort of reduce mattress displacement is what we call it. So the movement from one partner affecting the other. Now there are these individual mattress pads that you can individualize each side of the bed to accommodate different temperature preferences. But there are other issues that couples face too. Snoring, of course, is the big one.
Yeah.
That gets mentioned.
No. I was thinking of our sister-in-law. She had to like move to a different room in the house because her husband's snoring was so loud.
She's not alone in that. In fact, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine just came out with a report demonstrating that about a third of couples who were surveyed said that they at least some of the time sleep apart. And again, snoring is a major reason for that. That, you know, if you have somebody who is sleeping in the same bed or even in the same room with you that is snoring incredibly loud, that can really disrupt one's sleep. And so for some couples, sleeping apart in separate bedrooms is the strategy that works. And that's actually another purpose of my book and just the dialogue I'm trying to create around this topic, which is there's not one size fits all sleeping strategy for all couples. And the intensive amount of stigma that we have associated with the marital bed, as well as these beliefs that couples should do one thing and that's the only sign of a good relationship. Well, that's really quite crazy. It's like, this is a critically important health behavior. It occupies a lot of your time and it's a very intimate behavior. So we don't need society telling couples that there's one right way to do this. Rather, couples need to really be okay with having conversations about what's going to work best for them.
It's so interesting in our couples work, the workshops we do. So people often think, oh, we should always get along. And that's like, we should always sleep well together is another version of that versus, no, I'm actually distant and close to Susan all the way through a day. And that's okay. It's actually that we're connected, that we know that we're close or distant. And the same thing with the sleep behavior, you know, like, I don't like movement and somebody is moving. So yeah.
Absolutely. And really what I tell couples, and I'm sure also when you work with couples, I mean, in couples, conflict is inherent. It's part of being in a relationship. Yes. It's really how you engage in the conflict that matters. You can be toxic or you can engage in a healthy way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Very true. The same thing. Oh, and by the way, when you're poorly slept, you're more likely to engage in those toxic relationships.
Yeah, exactly.
Then we'll talk quite a bit about. So like that's what couples should be focused on. How do we sleep better so that I can be a better partner? Not how do we fall into these societally prescribed norms that may or may not work for us. And they're definitely not working if one or both of you is chronically sleep deprived. So that's how I'm really trying to change the conversation here.
Yeah. I was thinking about how often people could feel like, oh, I'm being abandoned if you go down the hall or sleep, you know, like there's something wrong with me. They can make it all about that versus we're just two people trying to take care of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it really depends on how the conversation happens, if it happens at all. Unfortunately, it often doesn't happen at all. It's just, you know, one partner stomps out of the room in frustration because they're sick of the snoring or the tossing and turning or the stealing of the bed sheets. And so a conversation doesn't actually happen. And when that happens, the other partner can feel rejected or abandoned. And by the way, here's another, just I think for me, fascinating aspect about sleep and why as a relationships researcher, I was so drawn to it. You know, we are at our most vulnerable in our relationships, in truly good quality ones. You could say the same thing about sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an evolutionarily vulnerable state to be in. And yet we absolutely need it for survival, just as we also need relationships for survival. You know, you're lying down, you're semi-conscious, it's dark, you're vulnerable to potential threats. So there's really close intersection between the vulnerability in our relationships and the vulnerability in our sleep. And it's sort of understandable that for some people, there are sort of very strong beliefs about I need to be close to my partner at night because it's very sort of much attached to those feelings of vulnerability. And that's why it's so important to have conversations in an open and honest way when a couple is experiencing challenges with regard to their sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. And not at 9 o'clock at night, probably like
4 or 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Right. So after the day, before sleep becomes the thing you're trying to get to, because that can also be like, oh my gosh, for me, I'm like, oh, I need it, you know, and you're in my way of getting it. So now you become my problem. And yeah, not healthy conversation starter.
Not a healthy conversation at all. Right. It becomes the sort of finger wagging and pointing and blaming instead of this mutually sort of beneficial and relationship enhancing goal of how do we become better partners to each other? And getting healthy sleep is really foundational in that goal because when we're better slept, we're better able to regulate our emotions. We're less irritable. We're less prone to conflict. We even show more empathic accuracy towards our partners when we're better slept. So we're better able to sort of read and interpret our partner's emotions when we get the sleep we need.
So how have you studied couples in the wild?
Couples in the wild, thanks to technology, and now there's lots of commercially available devices, you know, watch worn devices that provide a behavioral assessment of sleep. So this is what we do typically. I've used other methods as well, including sort of the gold standard polysomnography or PSG, but I do it in the home where we send lab techs to hook people up. And so at the very least, they're in their homes and sleeping. But nowadays, the technology with these wrist-worn devices has really come a long way. And so we can get most of the dimensions of sleep that we're interested in. And over a long period of time, which is also important because sleep is very variable. So you might have had a bad night of sleep last night, let's say, but that doesn't mean you're chronically a bad sleeper. Or your partner might have affected you last night, but maybe not always. So I like to study people's sleep in their own environments and over a longer period of time, usually about 2 weeks. So we start to see these habitual patterns. And usually I pair that with some sort of daily monitoring of their emotions, their interactions with their partner and other behaviors. So we can start to see these night to day and the bi-directional associations between how you sleep at night and how you treat your partner the next day.
Oh, wow. And have you noticed any themes, I would say, between same-sex couples, heterosexual couples? Because I do think sleep would be one area where, as two women, we deal with menopause, all sorts of things. I'd be curious, anything in your research?
I would say that it's woefully under-investigated at this point. Most studies thus far have been in predominantly heterosexual couples. So it's absolutely a need. The studies that are there generally show fairly similar patterns in terms of the, you know, in same-sex couples versus heterosexual couples in terms of how insufficient sleep affects relationship behaviors. That seems to be a commonality across. I mean, one thing, as you mentioned, when we're talking about if you pair two people of the same biological sex, in this case, women, you're going to face certain problems, such as both of you going through menopause, which is associated with sleep problems. So what happens when you put those two together? That's a fascinating question that just hasn't been addressed. What I can say on the flip side, among heterosexual couples, there is this very frequent challenge, which is that you pair biological male with a biological female. Biological males are statistically more likely to have the sleep disorder, sleep apnea, although women can have it too, but they're more likely to have apnea. Women, on the other hand, are more likely to have insomnia. So in heterosexual couples, you're basically pairing the loud sleeper with a light sleeper.
Yeah.
And some problems can emerge. So again, these sort of dynamics based on particular pairings of the couple are fascinating and have not been investigated nearly enough.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was just looking at a National Geographic article, actually, around how women have more issues related to lack of sleep than men do. And I imagine that may be paired with some of this insomnia idea. Or, you know, you think also, I don't know how it relates to even being a mom in the light sleeper, because they're more prone to wanting to hear if maybe than...
Or the hormones. I mean, like waking up more frequently because of that. Is there any information about that you've noticed?
In my book, I do talk quite a bit about sex differences and gender differences in sleep and some of the things that you called out. Yes, women are about twice as likely to have insomnia as compared to men. Men, however, are more likely to have sleep apnea and other sleep disorders. Women are also more likely to have restless leg syndrome. But what's interesting is there is this sort of, I don't know, paradox, I guess, that women tend to have poor sleep quality. But actually, if you measure sleep objectively, particularly in a laboratory setting, women actually tend to sleep more than men, but they experience their sleep as more disrupted. Mm-hmm. And that also sort of pairs with, again, what, you know, having treated many, many patients for many, many years, including many women, a very common story from, you know, many women I see is ever since I had children, I've just never slept the same. Wow. And, you know, it's this, you know, common woe. And it's partly that for many women, that the tendency to be vigilant at night that is needed when you're primarily responsible in many families for the nighttime caregiving, that becomes a learned habit and you sort of are conditioned to never shut your brain off. Mm. And that is a very common complaint of women and probably is somewhat hardwired. We're just still teasing it apart. Men and women do sleep differently. That is absolutely true. And it absolutely also intersects with the traditional social roles we sort of occupy. And of course, there's also significant hormonal changes that certainly affect sleep, though the research is not entirely sure exactly how, which would be really nice if it were, because if it were to say, oh, everybody just needs progesterone, well, everybody would be running out and getting progesterone. It's not that simple.
No.
What we know so far is, yes, hormonal changes are associated. Virtually any type of hormonal change throughout a woman's reproductive history is associated with some level of sleep disturbance. Some experience it more severely than others. So there's definitely this association, but we don't really know sort of the causal links or how to treat it necessarily yet.
Yeah.
Well, from a hormone basis.
Right. This is a different question, a little different, not totally. But, you know, with sleep apnea, I mean, it was interesting what you said. Women tend to sleep more, although the quality of their sleep is less. Sleep apnea, that's the snoring thing, right? But
and
there's
they wake
also...
up, right? Don't they wake up in the apnea?
They do. They don't get to the right sleep levels or something like that because they're waking up. Is that it? They don't get into the...
Well, they literally are not getting enough oxygen. There's periods of the night where they actually, their upper airway in obstructive sleep apnea collapses, and that's what causes the snoring and really the gasping for air. But yes, that frequent awakening, you know, and because when you stop breathing, your brain does do the right thing and it wakes you up. Now, when these are micro arousals, so the person might not even be aware of it, but it could be happening, you know, 50 to 60 times an hour.
Wow.
And so because of that fragmented sleep, they're never able to descend into those deeper stages of sleep or REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. That's really where it comes from. And so people with sleep apnea, and I should say, snoring is a symptom of sleep apnea, though there are absolutely people who are simple snorers. That is, they are snorers in the absence of having the clinical disorder of apnea. Right. People with apnea usually have other symptoms, including excessive daytime sleepiness, maybe morning headaches. And these are things, and it's really the associated with that disruption in the airway and the reduction in oxygen levels at night, which is it's a major health concern.
Wow.
Oh, now, because you study sleep, like I'm curious, and relationships, which is interesting. There's the idea that when you come into the home to do your sleeping in the wild, do you notice different qualities in sleep when people actually cuddle together or in contact, whether it's with another person or even people who have pets on their beds? Because there's all sorts of, you know, I'm just curious because contact is such an important part of relating. And I don't know how it relates to sleep.
Yeah, I would say in my work, we haven't quite gotten into those nuances yet. However, this is actually a really interesting thing about the science of paired sleep, and it's fairly limited. In studies that have looked at couples while sleeping together versus sleeping apart, so they either measure couples in their home or bring them in to a lab and have them either sleep together or apart. Interestingly enough, what they show is that when couples sleep together and the researcher measures their sleep objectively, for instance, using wrist-worn devices like actigraphs, they actually show worse sleep. They show some disruption in their sleep when sleeping together compared to on nights when they sleep alone. But if you ask those very same people, do you prefer to sleep with your partner or do you prefer to sleep alone? Most will say they prefer to sleep with their partner. So what this says to me is there's really this sort of disconnect between the psychological benefits that people often feel by sharing a bed or cuddling with a partner, the feeling of safety and security that we derive from closeness with a partner. And that, in many cases, overrides the objective consequences of sharing a bed, right? So there is this sort of disconnect between the psychological experience of safety and security, which is so tied with our relationships,
and sleep,
sort of the physical aspect of, well, when it really is like a physics question, you're like two people in a small space, there's more opportunity for movement, there's more opportunity for disruption. And that's not necessarily clinically significant. It's just that the markers are going to show there was more disruption on the shared bed nights versus the alone. Again, I talk about this research only to say this is just more evidence because the research itself is in conflict and it depends on how you measure sleep. There is not a one right way
to
sleep, right? And there's also not one right way for couples to cuddle, whether it's, you know, it really depends on that couple. But speaking of cuddling,
conversation, conversation.
But I do want to say the value of cuddling and just physical closeness and intimacy, particularly at night, there actually may be some neurobiological underpinnings of this. The hormone oxytocin, it's known as the love hormone or the social hormone, that's released among lactating females, but also during orgasm for both males and females, and also just with warm touch and closeness. Mm-hmm. And oxytocin is associated with reductions in anxiety level, sort of stress reducing, and can kind of promote a sense of well-being. So I do encourage all couples, even if they're going to go to separate bedrooms at night, try to ritualize some time in bed together before falling asleep, to talk about your day, to cuddle, to have some closeness, to hold hands, because there actually might be some hormonal benefits of releasing oxytocin, providing that calming relaxation response before heading off to bed.
That's great.
Yeah. Other tips you want to give our listeners as they go through this process with their partner around sleeping together or not?
Or not, right? And again, I'm not prescriptive in any way about this. What I want to encourage couples to do is first recognize that having challenges with your partner when it comes to sleep is not at all indicative of a sign of something wrong in your relationship. It's just a signal to have a conversation. And if you're going to have the conversation, do so in a way that's most likely to produce a positive outcome. So first of all, time it well. As you said, don't have these conversations in the middle of the night or when you're approaching bedtime, when we're all ready for bed, you know, and we're like our emotion regulation strategies aren't at their best. You want to be well slept and, you know, so have these any sort of difficult conversation. It's best to time it well. So time it well. Try to use, you know, some good relationship skills in general, like use I statements. I'm struggling with my sleep. And I want to know what we can do about it because it's so important for me to sleep well so I'm not snappy with you, for instance, instead of, you know, you're snoring or you're kicking me in bed or you're stealing the sheets and I'm not sleeping well. That kind of blaming just leads to sort of hostile interaction and can lead the partner to become defensive or withdrawal. And really be open to options, right? Just as sleeping together is not going to guarantee that you have a happy and healthy relationship, sleeping apart, if that's your choice, does not in any way mean that you have an unhappy or sexless relationship. There's lots of strategies to find happiness and intimacy, whether you share a bed or not. But it's really about starting to prioritize sleep as a cornerstone of your relationship.
Yeah, because it's a third of your of your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I love it. Well, Dr. Wendy, how can people find your book? Why don't you say a little bit about your book and learn more about you?
Great. Well, yeah. So my book is Sharing the Covers, Every Couple's Guide to Better Sleep. It's available on every online book outlet and hopefully maybe in some of your small bookstores if it's not aspirin. I'm also on Twitter at Wendy Troxel, and Instagram is Sharing the Covers, the title of my book. And you can also look up my TED Talks. One is on couples and sleep, and another is on adolescent sleep patterns and how early school start times are in conflict with adolescent sleep. So if you're a parent, that might be of interest to you as well. So yeah, those are some strategies.
That's great. And just that was really surprising, you know, that we make kids get up so early, the adolescents, and they should actually be sleeping quite late. Is that true? Tell me.
They're natural night owls. It's a developmentally specific time in their lives and human lives where there's this biological shift to stay awake later and sleep in later. And just at the time that this biological shift, which they are not in control of, happens, we start schools earlier and earlier. In fact, you know, the average school start time in the United States is 8 a.m., but many, many schools are far earlier than that. And just because the school bell may ring at 8 a.m. or 7:30 a.m., you've got to back up that child's wake-up time far earlier, because then you also think about the commute, the bus time. So many kids are actually out in the dark at 6:30 in the morning waiting for the bus. And that's a time that's actually in the middle of their biological night when they should be asleep. So it's essentially turning adolescents into night shift workers, sending them out of school in the middle of their biological night when their brains are least functional, when they're most emotionally unstable, and they really aren't in a good place to learn or be mentally and physically healthy. So it's really a policy level issue that's contributing to a crisis of insufficient sleep among teenagers.
Wow. Yeah. And you think of the whole like suicide things that come up in that age frame. Yes. And I think, probably related to
all of which we have prospective studies showing that sleep predicts increased risk of these things that are so terrifying to us as parents: suicide, substance use, risky driving, all of these things. And this is a policy level solution that could be employed and has been in many districts and even in the state of California at a statewide level to have healthy school start times. But yeah, we do need to do better by our kids.
That's great. Well, listeners, check out Dr. Wendy Troxel's TED Talks because they sound awesome. Thank you for being on our podcast. We really appreciate it.
Yes. Oh, it's really been a pleasure. Nice talking to you both.
Yes.
Well, thanks for joining us. We hope you found today's episode valuable. If you want to take some of what you've learned on today's episode to the next level, check out our new step-by-step, easy-to-use team kit to get your team from avoiding conflict to discovering the beauty in conflict.
Go to www.thriveinc.com/teamkit to learn more. That's www.thriveinc.com/teamkit.